glimpsed him sitting at one of the parasol-equipped tables which surrounded the country club's outdoor bar. He looked like a younger version of Marcus Welby, M.D. The poolside bar, which was called the Watering Hole, was where he and Halleck were now. Houston was wearing red golfing pants, held up with a shiny white belt. His feet were dressed in white golfing shoes. His shirt was Lacoste, his watch a Rolex. He was drinking a pina colada. One of his standard witticisms was referring to them as penis coladas. He and his wife had two eerily beautiful children and lived in one of the larger houses on Lantern Drive. They were in walking distance of the country club, a fact of which Jenny Houston boasted when she was drunk. It meant that their house had cost well over $150K. Houston drove a brown Mercedes four-door. She drove a Cadillac Cimarron that looked like a Rolls-Royce with hemorrhoids. Their kids went to a private school in Westport. Fairview gossip, which was true more often than not, suggested that Michael and Jenny Houston had reached a modus vivendi. He was an obsessive philanderer, and she started in on the whiskey sours around 3 in the afternoon. Just a typical Fairview family, Halleck thought, and suddenly felt tired as well as scared. He either knew these people too well, or thought he did, and either way, it came to the same. He looked down at his own shiny white shoes and thought, "Who are you kidding? You wear the tribal feather." "I want to see you in my office tomorrow," Houston said. "I've got a case." "Never mind your case. This is more important. In the meantime, tell me this. Have you had any bleeding? Rectal, mouth?" "No." "Notice any bleeding from the scalp when you comb your hair?" "No." "How about sores that don't want to heal or scabs that fall off and just reform?" "No." "Great," Houston said. By the way, I carded an 84 today. What do you think?" "I think it'll still be a couple of years before you make the Masters," Billy said. Houston laughed. The waiter came. Houston ordered another penis colada. Halleck ordered a Miller. "Miller Light," he almost told the waiter, force of habit, and then held his tongue. He needed a light beer like he needed, well, like he needed some rectal bleeding. Michael Houston leaned forward. His eyes were grave, and Halleck felt that fear again, like a smooth steel needle, very thin, probing at the lining of his stomach. He realized miserably that something had changed in his life, and not for the better. Not for the better at all. He was scared a lot now. Gypsy's revenge. Houston's grave eyes were fixed on Billy's, and Billy heard him say, "The chances that you have cancer are 5 in 6, Billy. I don't even need an X-ray to tell you that. Is your will up to date? Are Heidi and Linda provided for adequately? When you're a relatively young man, you don't think it can happen to you, but it can. It can." In the quiet tone of a man imparting great information, Houston asked, "How many pallbearers does it take to bury a nigger from Harlem?" Billy shook his head, smiling a counterfeit smile. 6, Houston said. 4 that carried a coffin, and 2 that carried a radio. He laughed, and Billy Halleck went through the motions. In his mind, clearly, he saw the gypsy man who had been waiting for him outside the Fairview courthouse. Behind the gypsy, at the curb in a no-parking zone, stood a huge old pickup truck with a homemade camper cap. The cap was covered with strange designs around a central painting, a not-very-good rendering of a unicorn on its knees, head bowed, before a gypsy woman with a garland of flowers in her hands. The gypsy man had been wearing a green twill vest with buttons made out of silver coins. Now, watching Houston laugh at his own joke, the alligator on his shirt riding the swells of his mirth, Billy thought, "You remember much more about that guy than you thought. You thought you only remembered his nose, but that's not true at all. You remember damn near everything." Children. There had been children in the cab of the old van, looking at him with depthless brown eyes, eyes that were almost black.
"Thinner,"
the old man had said, and in spite of his calloused flesh, his caress had been the caress of a lover. Delaware plates, Billy thought suddenly. His rig had Delaware plates and a bumper sticker. Something. Billy's arms dimpled out in goose flesh, and for one moment, He thought he might scream, as he had once heard a woman scream right here when she thought her child was drowning in the pool. Billy Halleck remembered how they had seen the gypsies for the first time, the day they had come to Fairview. They had parked along one side of the Fairview Town Common, and a flock of their kids had run out onto the greensward to play. The gypsy woman stood gossiping and watching them. They were brightly dressed, but not in the peasant garb an older person might have associated with the Hollywood version of gypsies in the 30s and 40s. There were women in colorful sundresses, women in calf-length clam-digger pants, younger women in Jordache or Calvin Klein jeans. They looked bright, alive, somehow dangerous. A young man jumped out of a VW microbus and began to juggle oversized bowling pins. "Everyone needs something to believe in," the young man's T-shirt read, "and right now I believe I'll have another beer." Fairview children ran toward him as if drawn by a magnet, yelling excitedly. Muscles rippled under the young man's shirt, and a giant crucifix bounded up and down on his chest. Fairview mothers gathered some of the kids up and bore them away. Other mothers were not as fast. Older town children approached the gypsy children, who stopped their play to watch them come. "Townies," their dark eyes said. "We see towny children everywhere the roads go. We know your eyes and your haircuts. We know how the braces on your teeth will flash in the sun. We don't know where we'll be tomorrow, but we know where you will be. Don't these same places and these same faces bore you? We think they do. We think that's why you always come to hate us." Billy, Heidi, and Linda Halleck had been there that day, 2 days before Halleck would strike and kill the old gypsy woman less than a quarter of a mile from here. They had been having a picnic lunch and waiting for the first band concert of the spring to begin. Most of the others abroad on the common that day had been there for the same reason, a fact the gypsies undoubtedly knew. Linda had gotten up, brushing at the seat of her Levi's as if in a dream, and started toward the young man juggling the bowling pins. "Linda, stay here," Heidi said sharply. Her hand had gone to the collar of her sweater, and she was fiddling there, as it often did when she was upset. Halleck didn't think she was even aware of it. "Why, Mom? It's a carnival. At least, I think it is." "They're gypsies," Heidi said. "Keep your distance. They're all crooks." Linda looked at her mother, then at her dad. Billy shrugged. She stood there looking as unaware of her wistful expression, Billy thought, as Heidi was of her hand at her collar, fiddling it uneasily up against her throat, and then back down again. The young man tossed his bowling pins back into the open side door of the microbus one by one, and a smiling, dark-haired girl, whose beauty was almost ethereal, tossed him 5 Indian clubs, one after another. The young man now began to juggle these, grinning, sometimes tossing one up under his arm and yelling, "Hoy!" each time he did it. An elderly man wearing Oshkosh bib overalls and a checkered shirt began handing out flyers. The lovely young woman who had caught the bowling pins and tossed out the Indian clubs now jumped lightly down from the van's doorway with an easel. She set it up, and Halleck thought, "She's going to exhibit bad seascapes and perhaps some pictures of President Kennedy." But instead of a painting, she propped a bullseye target on the easel. Someone from inside the van tossed her a slingshot. "Gina!" the boy juggling the Indian clubs yelled. He grinned broadly, revealing the absence of several front teeth. Linda sat down abruptly. Her concept of masculine beauty had been formed by a lifetime of network TV, and the young man's handsomeness had been spoiled for her. Heidi stopped fiddling with the collar of her cardigan. The girl flipped the slingshot to the boy. He dropped one of the clubs and began to juggle the slingshot in its place. Halleck remembered thinking, that must be almost impossible. The boy did it two or three times, then flipped the slingshot back to her and somehow managed to pick up the club he had dropped while keeping the others in the air. There was scattered applause. Some of the locals were smiling, Billy himself was, but most of them looked wary. The girl stepped away from the target on the easel, produced some ball bearings from her breast pocket, and shot three quick bullseyes. Plop, plop, plop. Soon she was surrounded by boys and a few girls, clamoring for a turn. She lined them up, organizing them as quickly and efficiently as a nursery school teacher prepares pupils for the 10:15 bathroom break. Two teenage gypsy boys of approximately Linda's age popped out of an old LTD station wagon and began to scruff the spent ammunition out of the grass. They were alike as two peas in a pod, obviously identical twins. One wore a gold hoop in his left ear. His brother wore the mate in his right. Is that how their mother tells them apart? Billy thought. No one was selling anything. Quite carefully, quite obviously, no one was selling anything. There was no Madame Mazonka telling the tarot. Nevertheless, a Fairview police car arrived soon enough, and two cops stepped out. One was Hopley, the chief of police, a roughly handsome man of about 40. Some of the action stopped, and more mothers took the opportunity the lull afforded to recapture their fascinated children and bear them away. Some of the older ones protested, and Halleck observed that some of the younger ones were in tears. Hopley began discussing the facts of life with the gypsy who had been doing the juggling act. His Indian clubs, painted in jaunty red and blue stripes, were now scattered around his feet. And the older gypsy, in the Oshkosh bibles. Oshkosh said something. Hopley shook his head. Then the juggler said something and began to gesticulate. As the juggler spoke, he moved closer to the patrolman who had accompanied Hopley. Now the tableau began to remind Halleck of something, and after a moment it came. It was like watching baseball players argue with the umps over a close call in a game. Oshkosh put a hand on juggler's arm, pulling him back a step or two, and that enhanced the impression, the manager trying to keep the young hothead from getting the boot. The young man said something more. Hopley shook his head again. The young man began to shout, but the wind was wrong, and Billy got only sounds, no words. "What's happening, Mom?" Linda asked, frankly fascinated. "Nothing, dear," Heidi said. Suddenly she was busy wrapping things. "Are you done eating?" "Yes, please. Daddy, what's going on?" For a moment it was on the tip of his tongue to say, "You're watching a classic scene, Linda. It's right up there with the rape of the Sabine women. This one is called The Rousting of the Undesirables." But Heidi's eyes were on his face. Her mouth was tight, and she obviously felt this was not a time for misplaced levity. "Not much," he said. "A little difference of opinion." In truth, not much was the truth. No dogs were unleashed, there were no swinging billy clubs, no black Mariah pulled up to the edge of the common. In an almost theatrical act of defiance, juggler shook off Oshkosh's grip, picked up his Indian clubs, and began to juggle them again. Anger had screwed up his reflexes, however, and now it was a poor show. Two of them fell to the ground almost at once. One struck his foot, and some kid laughed. Hopley's partner moved forward impatiently. Hopley, not put out of countenance at all, restrained him much as Oshkosh had restrained Juggler. Hopley leaned back against an elm tree, with his thumbs hooked into his wide belt, looking at nothing in particular. He said something to the other cop, and the patrolman produced a notebook from his hip pocket. He wet the ball of his thumb, opened the book, and strolled to the nearest car, a converted Cadillac hearse of early 60s vintage. He began writing it up. He did this with great ostentation. When he had finished, he moved on to the VW microbus. Oshkosh approached Hopley and began to speak urgently. Hopley shrugged and looked away. The patrolman moved on to an old Ford sedan. Oshkosh left Hopley and went to the young man. He spoke earnestly, his hands moving in the warm spring air. For Billy Halleck, The scene was losing whatever small interest that it held for him. He was beginning not to see the gypsies, who had made the mistake of stopping in Fairview on their way from Hoot to Holler. Juggler abruptly turned and went back to the microbus, simply allowing his remaining Indian clubs to drop onto the grass. The microbus had been parked behind the pickup with the woman and the unicorn painted on the homemade camper cap. Oshkosh bent to retrieve them, speaking anxiously to Hopley as he did so. Hopley shrugged again, and although Billy Halleck was in no way telepathic, he knew Hopley was enjoying this as well as he knew that he and Heidi and Linda would be having leftovers for supper. The young woman who had been shooting ball bearings at the target tried to speak to Juggler, but he brushed by her angrily and stepped into the microbus. She stood for a moment looking at Oshkosh, whose arms were full of Indian clubs, and then she also went into the bus. Halleck could erase the others from his field of perception, but for a moment she was impossible not to see. Her hair was long and naturally wavy, not bound in any way. It fell to below her shoulder blades in a black, almost barbarous flood. Her print blouse and modestly kick-pleated skirt might have come from Sears or J.C. Penney's, but her body was exotic as that of some rare cat, a panther, a cheetah, a snow leopard. As she stepped into the van, the pleat at the back of her skirt shifted for a moment, and he saw the lovely line of her inner thigh. In that moment, he wanted her utterly, and he saw himself on top of her in the blackest hour of the night. And that want felt very old. He looked back at Heidi, and now her lips were pressed together so tightly they were white, her eyes like dull coins. She had not seen his look, but she had seen the shift in the kick pleat, what it revealed, and understood it perfectly. The cop with the notebook stood watching until the girl was gone. Then he closed his notebook, put it back in his pocket, and rejoined Hopley. The gypsy women were shooing their children back to the caravan. Oshkosh, his arms full of Indian clubs, approached Hopley again and said something. Hopley shook his head with finality. And that was it. A second Fairview police cruiser pulled up, its flashers turning lazily. Oshkosh glanced at it, then glanced around at the Fairview Town Common with its expensive, safety-tested playground equipment and its band shell. Streamers of crepe still fluttered gaily from some of the budding trees, leftovers from the Easter egg hunt the Sunday before. Oshkosh went back to his own car, which was at the head of the line. As its motor roared into life, all the other motors did likewise. Most were loud and choppy. Halleck heard a lot of missing pistons and saw a lot of blue exhaust. Oshkosh's station wagon pulled out, bellowing and farting. The others fell into line, heedless of the local traffic bound past the common and toward downtown. "They've all got their lights on," Linda exclaimed. "Golly, it's like a funeral." "There's two ring-dings left," Heidi said briskly. "Have one." "I don't want one. I'm full. Daddy, are those people—" "You'll never have a 38-inch bust if you don't eat," Heidi told her. "I've decided I don't want a 38-inch bust," Linda said, doing one of her great lady bits. They always knocked Halleck out. "S's are in these days." "Linda Joan Halleck." "I'll have a ring-ding," Halleck said. Heidi looked at him briefly, coolly. "Oh, is that what you'll have?" and then tossed it to him. She lit a Vantage 100. Billy ended up eating both of the ring-dings. Heidi smoked half a pack of cigarettes before the band concert was over and ignored Billy's clumsy efforts to cheer her up. But she warmed up on the way home, and the gypsies were forgotten. At least, until that night. When he went into Linda's room to kiss her good night, she asked him, "Were the police running those guys out of town, Dad?" Billy remembered looking at her carefully, feeling both annoyed and absurdly flattered by her question. She went to Heidi when she wanted to know how many calories were in a piece of German chocolate cake. She came to Billy for harder truths, and he sometimes felt this was not fair. He sat on her bed, thinking that she was still very young, and very sure she was on that side of the line where the good guys unquestionably stood. She could be hurt. A lie could avoid that hurt. But lies about the sort of thing that had happened that day on the Fairview Common had a way of coming back to haunt the parents. Billy could very clearly remember his father telling him that masturbation would make him stutter. His father had been a good man in almost all ways, but Billy had never forgiven him that lie. Yet Linda had already run him a hard course. They had been through gays, oral sex, venereal disease, and the possibility that there was no God. It had taken having a child to teach him just how tiring honesty could be. Suddenly, he thought of Ginelli. What would Ginelli tell his daughter if he was here now? You gotta keep the undesirables out of town, sweetness, because that is really what it's all about. Just keeping the undesirables out of town. But that was more truth than he could muster. Yes, I suppose they were. They were gypsies, hon. Vagabonds. Mom said they were crooks. Well, a lot of them run crooked games and tell fake fortunes. When they come to a town like Fairview, the police ask them to move on. Usually they put up a show of being mad, but they really don't mind. Bang. A little flag went up inside his head. Lie number one. They hand out posters or flyers saying where they'll be. Usually they make a cash deal with a farmer or with someone who owns a field outside of town. After a few days, they leave. Why do they come at all? What do they do? Well, there are always people who want their fortunes read, and there are games of chance, gambling. Usually they are crooked. Or maybe a fast exotic lay, Halleck thought. He saw the kick pleat of the girl's skirt shift again as she stepped into the van. How would she move? His mind answered, like the ocean getting ready to storm, that's how. Do people buy drugs from them? Hashish, maybe, he said, or opium. He had come to this part of Connecticut as a teenager, and had been here ever since, in Fairview and neighboring Northport. He hadn't seen any gypsies in almost 25 years. Not since he had been a kid growing up in North Carolina, when he had lost $5, an allowance saved up carefully over almost 3 months to buy his mother a birthday present, playing the Wheel of Fortune. They weren't supposed to allow anyone under 16 to play, but, of course, if you had the coin or the long green, you could step up and put it down. Some things never changed, he reckoned, and chief among them was the old adage that when money talks, nobody walks. If asked before today, he would have shrugged and guessed that there were no more traveling gypsy caravans. But, of course, the wandering breed never died out. They came in rootless and left the same way, human tumbleweeds who cut whatever deals they could and then blew out of town with dollars in their greasy wallets that had been earned on the time clocks they themselves spurned. They survived. Hitler had tried to exterminate them along with the Jews and the homosexuals, but they would outlive 1,000 Hitlers, he supposed. I thought the common was public property, Linda said. That's what we learned in school. Well, in a way it is, Halleck said. Common means commonly owned by the townspeople, the taxpayers. Bang. Lie number two. Taxation had nothing at all to do with common land in New England, ownership of or use of. See Richards versus Jerram, New Hampshire, or Baker versus Olins. That one went back to 1835, or... The taxpayers, she said in a musing voice. You need a permit to use the common. Clang. Lie number three. That idea had been overturned in 1931, when a bunch of poor potato farmers set up a Hooverville in the heart of Lewiston, Maine. The city had appealed to Roosevelt's Supreme Court and hadn't even gotten a hearing. That was because the Hooverites had picked Pettingill Park to camp in, and Pettingill Park happened to be common land. Like when the Shrine Circus comes, he amplified. Why didn't the gypsies get a permit, Dad? She sounded sleepy now. Thank God. Well, maybe they forgot. Not a snowball's chance in hell, Lynn. Not in Fairview. Not when you see the common from Lantern Drive and the country club. Not when that view is part of what you paid for, along with the private schools, which teach computer programming on banks of brand new apples and TRS-80s, and the relatively clean air and the quiet at night. The Shrine Circus is okay. The Easter egg hunt is even better, but gypsies? Here's your hat. What's your hurry? We know dirt when we see it. Not that we touch it, Christ, no. We have maids and housekeepers to get rid of dirt in our houses. When it shows up on the town common, we've got Hopley. But those truths are not for a girl in junior high, Halleck thought. Those are truths that you learn in high school and in college. Maybe you get it from your sorority sisters, or maybe it just comes like a short-wave transmission from outer space. Not our kind, dear. Stay away. Good night, Daddy. Good night, Lynn. He had kissed her again and left. Rain, driven by a sudden strong gust of wind, slatted against his study window, and Halleck awoke as if from a doze. Not our kind, dear, he thought again, and actually laughed in the silence. The sound made him afraid, because only loonies laughed in an empty room. Loonies did that all the time. It was what made them loony. Not our kind. If he had never believed it before, he believed it now. Now that he was thinner. Halleck watched as Houston's nurse drew 1, 2, 3 ampules of blood from his left arm and put them into a carrier like eggs in a carton. Earlier, Houston had given him 3 stool cards and told him to mail them in. Halleck pocketed them glumly, and then bent over for the proctological, dreading the humiliation of it, as always, more than the minor discomfort. That feeling of being invaded. Fullness. Relax, Houston said, snapping on the thin rubber glove. As long as you can't feel both of my hands on your shoulders, you're all right. He laughed heartily. Halleck closed his eyes. Houston saw him 2 days later. He had, he said, seen to it that his blood work was given priority. Halleck sat down in the den-like room, pictures of clipper ships on the walls, deep leather chairs, deep pile gray rug, where Houston did his consulting. His heart was hammering hard, and he felt droplets of cold sweat nestled at each temple. "I'm not going to cry in front of a man that tells nigger jokes," he told himself with fierce grimness, and not for the first time. "If I have to cry, I'll drive out of town and park the car and do it." "Everything looks fine," Houston said mildly. Halleck blinked. The fear had by now rooted deep enough so that he was positive he had misheard Houston. "What?" "Everything looks fine," Houston repeated. "We can do some more tests if you want, Billy, but I don't see the point right now. Your blood looks better than it has at your last 2 physicals, as a matter of fact. Cholesterol is down, same with the triglycerides. You've lost some more weight. The nurse got you at 217 this morning. But what can I say? You're still almost 30 pounds over your optimum weight, and I don't want you to lose sight of that, but, he grinned. "I'd sure like to know your secret." "I don't have one," Halleck said. He felt both confused and tremendously relieved, the way he had felt on a couple of occasions in college when he had passed tests for which he was unprepared.
"We'll hold judgment in abeyance until we get the results on your Heyman-Reichling series."
"My what?"
"The shit cards," Houston said, and then laughed heartily. "Something might show up there, but really, Billy, the lab ran 23 different tests on your blood, and they all look good. That's persuasive."
Halleck let out a long, shaky sigh. "I was scared," he said.
"It's the people who aren't who die young," Houston replied.
He opened his desk drawer and took out a bottle with a small spoon dangling from the cap by a chain. The spoon's handle, Halleck saw, was in the shape of the Statue of Liberty.
"Toot sweet?"
Halleck shook his head. He was content, however, to sit where he was, with his hands laced together on his belly, on his diminished belly, and watch as Fairview's most successful family practitioner snorted coke first up one nostril and then up the other. He put the little bottle back in his desk and took out another bottle and package of Q-tips. He dipped a Q-tip in the bottle and then rammed it up his nose. "Distilled water," he said. "Got to protect the sinuses." And he tipped Halleck a wink.
"He's probably treated babies for pneumonia with that shit running around in his head," Halleck thought. But the thought had no real power. Right now he couldn't help liking Houston a little, because Houston had given him good news. Right now, all he wanted in the world was to sit here with his hands laced across his diminished belly and explore the depth of his shaky relief, to try it out like a new bicycle or test drive it like a new car. It occurred to him that when he walked out of Houston's office, he was probably going to feel almost newborn. A director filming the scene might well want to put Thus Spake Zarathustra on a soundtrack. This thought made Halleck first grin, then laugh aloud.
"Share the funny," Houston said. "In this sad world, we need all the funnies we can get, Billy boy."
He sniffed loudly and then lubricated his nostrils with a fresh Q-tip. "Nothing," Halleck said. "It's just, I was scared, you know. I was already dealing with the big C, trying to."
"Well, you may have to," Houston said, "but not this year. I don't need to see the lab results on the Heyman-Reichling carts to tell you that. Cancer's got a look, at least when it's already gobbled up 30 pounds, it does."
"But I've been eating as much as ever.
I told Heidi I'd been exercising more, and I have, a little. But she said you couldn't lose 30 pounds just by beefing up your exercise regimen. She said you'd just make hard fat."
"Oh, that's not true at all. The most recent tests have showed exercise is much more important than diet. But for a guy who is, who was, as overweight as you were, she's got a point. You take a fatty who radically increases his level of exercise, and what the guy usually gets is the booby prize, a good solid class 2 thrombosis. Not enough to kill you, but just enough to make sure you're never going to walk around all 18 holes again, or ride the big roller coaster at Seven Flags over Georgia."
Billy thought the cocaine was making Houston talkative.
"You don't understand it," he said. "I don't understand it either. But in this business, I see a lot of things I don't understand. A friend of mine who's a neurosurgeon in the city called me in to look at some extraordinary cranial x-rays about 3 years ago. A male student at George Washington University came in to see him because he was having blinding headaches. They sounded like typical migraines to my colleague. The kid fit the personality type to a T. But you don't want to screw around with that sort of thing because headaches like that are symptomatic of cranial brain tumors, even if the patient isn't having phantom olfactory reference, smells like shit or rotten fruit or old popcorn or whatever. So my buddy took a full x-ray series, gave the kid an EEG, sent him to the hospital to have a cerebral axial tomography. You know what they found out?"
Halleck shook his head.
"They found out that the kid, who had stood third in his high school class and who had been on the dean's list every semester at George Washington University, had almost no brain at all. There was a single twist of cortical tissue running up through the center of his skull. On the x-rays my colleague showed me, it looked for all the world like a macrame drape pull. And that was all. That drape pull was probably running all of his involuntary functions, everything from breathing and heart rate to orgasm. Just that one rope of brain tissue. The rest of the kid's head was filled with nothing but cerebrospinal fluid. In some way we don't understand, that fluid was doing his thinking. Anyway, he's still excelling in school, still having migraines, and still fitting the migraine personality type. If he doesn't have a heart attack in his 20s or 30s that kills him, they'll start to taper off in his 40s.
Houston pulled the drawer open, took out the cocaine, and took some. He offered it to Halleck. Halleck shook his head.
"Then," Houston resumed, "about 5 years ago, I had an old lady come into the office with a lot of pain in her gums. She's died since. If I mentioned the old bitch's name, you'd know it. I took a look in there, and Christ Almighty, I couldn't believe it. She'd lost the last of her adult teeth almost 10 years before. I mean, this babe was pushing 90, and here was a bunch of new ones coming up. 5 of them in all. No wonder she was having gum pain, Billy. She was growing a third set of teeth. She was teething at 88 years of age."
"What did you do?" Halleck asked. He was hearing all of this with only a very limited part of his mind. It flowed over him, soothing like white noise, like muzak floating down from the ceiling in a discount department store. Most of his mind was still dealing with relief. Surely Houston's cocaine must be a poor drug indeed compared to the relief he was feeling. Halleck thought briefly of the old gypsy with the rotten nose, but the image had lost its darkish, oblique power.
"What did I do?" Houston was asking. "Christ, what could I do? I wrote her a prescription for a drug that's really nothing more than a high-powered form of Numzit, that stuff you put on a baby's gums when it starts to teeth. Before she died, she got three more in, two molars and a canine. I've seen other stuff, too, a lot of it. Every doctor sees weird shit he can't explain. But enough of Ripley's Believe It or Not. The fact is, we don't understand very goddamn much about the human metabolism. There are guys like Duncan Hopley. You know Dunk. Halleck nodded. Fairview's chief of police, rouster of gypsies, who looked like a Bush League Clint Eastwood. He eats like every meal was his last one, Houston said. Holy Moses, I never seen such a bear for chow. But his weight sticks right around 170, and because he's 6 feet tall, that makes him just about right. He's got a souped-up metabolism. He's burning the calories off at twice the pace of, let's say, Yard Stevens. Halleck nodded. Yard Stevens owned and operated Heads Up, Fairview's only barbershop. He went maybe 300 pounds. You looked at him and wondered if his wife tied his shoelaces. Yard is roughly the same height as Duncan Hopley, Houston said. But the times I've seen him at lunch, he's just picking at his food. Maybe he's a big closet eater. Could be. But I'd guess not. He's got a hungry face. You know what I mean? Billy smiled a little and nodded. He knew. Yard Stevens looked, in his mother's phrase, like his food wasn't doing him any good. I'll tell you something else, too, although I suppose it's tales out of school. Both of those men smoke. Yard Stevens claims a pack of Marlboro Lights a day, which means he probably smokes a pack and a half, maybe two. Duncan claims he smokes two packs of Camels a day, which could mean he's doing three and a half. I mean, did you ever see Duncan Hopley without a cigarette in his mouth or in his hand? Billy thought about it and shook his head. Meanwhile, Houston had helped himself to another blast. "Gah, that's enough of that," he said, and slammed the drawer shut with authority. "Anyway, there's Yard doing a pack and a half of low-tar cigarettes a day, and there's Duncan doing three packs of Black Lungers every day, maybe more. But the one who's really inviting lung cancer to come in and eat him up is Yard Stevens. Why? Because his metabolism sucks, and metabolic rate is somehow linked to cancer. You have doctors who claim that we can cure cancer when we crack the genetic code. Some kinds of cancer, maybe. But it's never going to be cured completely until we understand metabolism. Which brings us back to Billy Halleck, the incredible shrinking man. Or maybe the incredible mass-reducing man would be better. Not mass-producing, mass-reducing. Houston laughed a strange and rather stupid, whinnying laugh, and Billy thought, if that's what coke does to you, maybe I'll stick to ringdings. You don't know why I'm losing weight? Nope. Houston seemed pleased by the fact. But my guess is that you may actually be thinking yourself thin. It can be done, you know. We see it fairly often. Someone comes in who really wants to lose weight. Usually they've had some kind of scare, heart palpitations, a fainting spell while playing tennis or badminton or volleyball, something like that. So I give them a nice, soothing diet that should enable them to lose 2 to 5 pounds a week for a couple of months. You can lose 16 to 40 pounds with no pain or strain that way. Fine. Except most people lose a lot more than that. They follow the diet, but they lose more weight than the diet alone can explain. It's as if some mental sentry who's been fast asleep for years wakes up and starts hollering the equivalent of fire. The metabolism itself speeds up because the sentry told it to evacuate a few pounds before the whole house burned down. Okay, Halleck said. He was willing to be convinced. He had taken the day off from work. And suddenly, what he wanted to do more than anything else was go home and tell Heidi he was okay and take her upstairs and make love to her while the afternoon sunlight shafted in through the windows of their bedroom. I'll buy that. Houston got up to see him out. Halleck noticed, with quiet amusement, that there was a dusting of white powder under Houston's nose. If you continue to lose weight, we'll run an entire metabolic series on you, Houston said. I may have given you the idea that tests like that aren't very good, but sometimes they can show us a lot. Anyway, I doubt if we'll have to go to that. My guess is your weight loss will start to taper off. 5 pounds this week, 3 next week, 1 the week after that. Then you're going to get on the scales and see that you've put on a pound or two.
"You've eased my mind a lot," Halleck said, and gripped Houston's hand hard. Houston smiled complacently, although he had really done no more than present Halleck with negatives. No, he didn't know what was wrong with Halleck, but no, it wasn't cancer.
Phew. "That's what we're here for, Billy Boy."
Billy Boy went home to his wife.
"He said you're okay?"
Halleck nodded. She put her arms around him and hugged him hard. He could feel the tempting swell of her breasts against his chest. "Want to go upstairs?" She looked at him, her eyes dancing.
"My, you are okay, aren't you?"
"You bet." They went upstairs and had magnificent sex. For one of the last times. Afterward, Halleck fell asleep and dreamed. The gypsy had turned into a huge bird, a vulture with a rotting beak. It was cruising over Fairview and casting down a gritty, cindery dust-like chimney soot that seemed to come from beneath its dusky pinions, its wing pits.
"Thinner,"
the gypsy vulture croaked, passing over the common, over the village pub, the Walden books on the corner of Main and Devon, over Esta Esta, Fairview's moderately good Italian restaurant, over the post office, over the Amoco station, the modern glass-walled Fairview Public Library, and finally over the salt marshes and out into the bay. Thinner. Just that one word. But it was malediction enough, Halleck saw, because everyone in this affluent, upper-class commute to the city and have a few drinks in the club car on the way home suburb, everyone in this pretty little New England town set squarely in the heart of John Cheever country, everyone in Fairview was starving to death. He walked faster and faster up Main Street, apparently invisible. The logic of dreams, after all, is only whatever the dream demands, and horrified by the results of the gypsy's curse. Fairview had become a town filled with concentration camp survivors. Big-headed babies with wasted bodies screamed from expensive prams. Two women in expensive designer dresses staggered and lurched out of Cherry on Top, Fairview's version of the old ice cream shop. Their faces were all cheekbones and bulging brows, stretching parchment-shiny skin. The necklines of their dresses slipped from jutting skin-wrapped collarbones and deep shoulder hollows in a hideous parody of seduction. Here came Michael Houston, staggering along on scarecrow-thin legs, his Savile Row suit flapping around his unbelievably gaunt frame, holding out a vial of cocaine in one skeletal hand.
"Toot sweet!" he screamed at Halleck.
It was the voice of a rat caught in a trap and squealing out the last of its miserable life.
"Toot sweet! It helps speed up your metabolism, Billy Boy! Toot sweet! Toot!"
With deepening horror, Halleck realized the hand holding the vial was not a hand at all, but only clattering bones. The man was a walking, talking skeleton. He turned to run, but in the way of nightmares he could seem to pick up no speed. Although he was on the Main Street sidewalk, he felt as if he was running in thick, sticky mud. At any moment, the skeleton that had been Michael Houston would reach out and it, would touch his shoulder, or perhaps that bony hand would begin to scrabble at his throat.
"Toot sweet, toot sweet, toot sweet,"
Houston's squalling, rat-like voice screamed. The voice was drawing closer and closer. Halleck knew that if he turned his head, the apparition would be close to him, so very close, sparkling eyes bulging from sockets of naked bone, the uncovered jawbone jerking and snapping. He saw Yard Stevens shamble out of heads up, his beige barber smock flapping over a chest and a belly that were now non-existent. Yard was screeching in a horrid, crow-like voice, and when he turned toward Halleck, he saw it was not Yard at all, but Ronald Reagan.
"Where's the rest of me?" he screamed. "Where's the rest of me? Where's the rest of me?" "Thinner,"
Michael Houston was now whispering into Halleck's ear, and now what Halleck had feared happened. Those finger bones touched him, twiddling and twitching at his sleeve, and Halleck thought he would go mad at the feeling.
"Thinner, so much thinner, toodle sweet, and thindy thin, it was his wife, Billy Boy, his wife, and you're in trouble, oh baby, so much trouble."
Billy jerked awake, breathing hard, his hand clapped across his mouth. Heidi slept peacefully beside him, deeply buried in a quilt. A mid-spring wind was running around the eaves outside. Halleck took one quick, fearful look around the bedroom, assuring himself that Michael Houston, or a scarecrow version of him, was not in attendance. It was just his bedroom, every corner of it known. The nightmare began to drain away, but there was still enough of it left so that he scooted over next to Heidi. He did not touch her. She woke easily. But he got into the zone of her warmth and stole part of her quilt. Just a dream. Thinner, a voice in his mind answered implacably. Sleep came again. Eventually. The morning following the nightmare, the bathroom scales showed him at 215, and Halleck felt hopeful. Only 2 pounds. Houston had been right, coke or not. The process was slowing down. He went downstairs whistling and ate 3 fried eggs and 6 link sausages. On his ride to the train station, the nightmare recurred to him in vague fashion, more as a feeling of déjà vu than actual memory. He looked out the window as he passed Heads Up, which was flanked by Frank's Fine Meats and Toys R Joys, and for just a moment he expected to see a half-score of lurching, shambling skeletons, as if comfortable, plushy Fairview had somehow been changed into Biafra. But the people on the streets looked okay. Better than okay. Yard Stevens, as physically substantial as ever, waved. Halleck waved back and thought, "Your metabolism is warning you to quit smoking, Yard." The thought made him smile a little, and by the time his train pulled into Grand Central, the last vestiges of the dream were forgotten. His mind at rest on the matter of his weight loss, Halleck neither weighed himself nor thought much about the matter for another 4 days. And then an embarrassing thing very nearly happened to him, in court and in front of Judge Hilmer Boynton, who had no more sense of humor than your average land turtle. It was stupid, the kind of thing you had bad dreams about when you were a grade school kid. Halleck stood to make an objection, and his pants started to fall down. He got halfway up, felt them sliding relentlessly down his hips and buttocks, bagging at the knees, and he sat down very quickly. In one of those moments of almost total objectivity, the ones which come unbidden and which you would often just as soon have forgotten, Halleck realized that his movement must have looked like some sort of bizarre hop. William Halleck, attorney at law, does his Peter Rabbit riff. He felt a blush mount into his cheeks.
"Is it an objection, Mr. Halleck, or a gas attack?"
The spectators, mercifully few of them, tittered.
"Nothing, Your Honor," Halleck muttered. I changed my mind."
Boynton grunted. The proceedings droned on, and Halleck sat sweating, wondering just how he was going to get up. The judge called a recess 10 minutes later. Halleck sat at the defense table pretending to pore over a sheaf of papers. When the hearing room was mostly empty, he rose, hands stuffed into his suit coat pockets in a gesture he had hoped looked casual. He was actually holding his trousers up through his pockets. He took off the suit coat in the privacy of a men's room stall, hung it up, looked at his pants, and then took off his belt. His pants, still buttoned and zipped, slithered down to his ankles. His change made a muffled jingle as his pockets struck the tile. He sat down on the toilet, held the belt up like a scroll, and looked at it. He could read a story there which was more than unsettling. The belt had been a Father's Day present 2 years ago from Linda. He held the belt up, reading it, and felt his heart speeding up to a frightened run. The deepest indention in the neat belt was just beyond the first hole. His daughter had bought it a little small, and Halleck remembered thinking at the time, ruefully, that it was perhaps forgivable optimism on her part. It had, nevertheless, been quite comfortable for a long while. It was only since he'd quit smoking that it got to be a bit hard to buckle the belt, even using the first hole. After he'd quit smoking, but before he'd hit the gypsy woman. Now there were other indents in the belt, beyond the second hole, and the fourth, and the fifth, finally, the sixth and last. Halleck saw with growing horror that each of the indents was lighter than the last.
His belt told a truer, briefer story than Michael Houston had done. The weight loss was still going on, and it wasn't slowing down. It was speeding up. He had gotten to the last hole in the neck belt he'd believed only 2 months ago he would have to quietly retire as too small. Now he needed a seventh hole, which he didn't have. He looked at his watch and saw that he'd have to get back soon. But some things were more important than whether or not Judge Boynton decided to enter a will into probate. Halleck listened. The men's room was quiet. He held up his pants with one hand and stepped out of the stall. He let his pants drop again and looked at himself in one of the mirrors over the row of sinks. He raised the tails of his shirt in order to get a better look at the belly, which until just lately had been his bane. A small sound escaped his throat. That was all, but that was enough. The selective perception couldn't hold up. It shattered all at once. He saw that the modest pot belly, which had replaced his bay window, was now gone. Although his pants were down and his shirt was pulled up over his unbuttoned vest, the facts were clear enough in spite of the ludicrous pose. Actual facts, as always, were negotiable. You learned that quickly in the lawyer business. But the metaphor which came was more than persuasive. It was undeniable. He looked like a kid dressed up in his father's clothes. Halleck stood in disarray before the short row of sinks, thinking hysterically, "Who's got the shinola? I've got to daub on a fake mustache." A gagging, rancid laughter rose in his throat at the sight of his pants bundled around his shoes and his black nylon socks climbing three-quarters of the way up his hairy calves. In that moment, he suddenly, simply believed everything. The gypsy had cursed him, yes, but it wasn't cancer. Cancer would have been too kind and too quick. It was something else, and the unfolding had only begun. A conductor's voice shouted in his mind, "Next stop, anorexia nervosa, all out for anorexia nervosa." The sounds rose in his throat. Laughter that sounded like screams, or perhaps screams that sounded like laughter, and what did it really matter? "Who can I tell? Can I tell Heidi? She'll think I'm crazy." But Halleck had never felt saner in his life. The outer door of the men's room banged open. Halleck retreated quickly into the stall and latched it, frightened. "Billy?" John Parker, his assistant. "In here." "Boynton's coming back soon. You okay?" "Fine," he said. His eyes were shut. "Do you have gas? Is it your stomach?" "Yeah, it's my stomach, all right."
"I just got to mail a package. I'll be out in a minute or so."
"Okay." Parker left. Halleck's mind fixed on his belt. He couldn't go back into Judge Boynton's court, holding up his pants through the pockets of his suit coat. What the hell was he going to do? He suddenly remembered his Swiss Army knife, good old Army knife, which he had always taken out of his pocket before weighing himself, back in the old days, before the gypsies had come to Fairview. "No one asked you assholes to come. Why couldn't you have gone to Westport or Stratford instead?" He took the knife out and quickly cored a seventh hole in the belt. It was ragged and unlovely, but it worked. Halleck buckled the belt, put on his coat, and exited the stall. For the first time, he was aware of just how much his pants were swishing around his legs, his thin legs. "Have other people been seeing it?" he thought with fresh and stinging embarrassment. "Seeing how poorly my clothes fit? Seeing and pretending not to? Talking?" He splashed water on his face and left the men's room. As he came back into the courtroom, Boynton was just entering in a swish of black robes. He looked forbiddingly at Billy, who made a wan gesture of apology. Boynton's face remained fixed, apology definitely not accepted. The droning began again. Somehow, Billy got through the day. He stood on the scales that night after Heidi and Linda were both asleep, looking down, not believing. He looked for a long, long time. 195. The next day he went out and bought clothes. He bought them feverishly, as if new clothes, clothes that fit him well, would solve everything. He bought a new, smaller Neek belt as well. He became aware that people had stopped complimenting him on his weight loss. When had that started? He didn't know. He put on the new clothes. He went to work and came home. He drank too much, ate second helpings that he didn't want and which sat heavily in his stomach. A week passed, and the new clothes did not look trim and neat anymore. They had begun to bag. He approached the bathroom scales, his heart thudding so heavily that it made his eyes throb and his head ache. He would discover later that he had bitten his lower lip hard enough to make it bleed. The image of the scale had taken on childish overtones of terror in his mind. The scale had become the goblin of his life. He stood before it for perhaps as long as 3 minutes, biting down hard on his lower lip, unaware of either the pain or the salty taste of blood in his mouth. It was evening. Downstairs, Linda was watching Three's Company on TV, and Heidi was running the weekly household accounts on the Commodore in Halleck's study. With a kind of lunge, he got onto the scale. 188. He felt his stomach roll over in a single giddy tumble, and for one desperate moment it seemed impossible that he would not vomit. He struggled grimly to keep his supper down. He needed that nourishment, those warm, healthy calories. At last the nausea passed. He looked down at the calibrated dial, dully remembering what Heidi had said. "It doesn't weigh heavy, it weighs light." He remembered Michael Houston saying that at 217 he was still 30 pounds over his optimum weight. "Not now, Mikey," he thought tiredly. "Now I'm thinner." He got off the scales, aware that he now felt a certain measure of relief, the relief a death-row prisoner might feel, seeing the warden and the priest appear at 12:02, knowing that the end had come and there was going to be no call from the governor. There were certain formalities to be gone through, of course, yes, but that was all. It was real. If he talked about it to people, they would think he was either joking or crazy. No one believed in gypsy curses anymore, or maybe never had. They were definitely de classe in a world that had watched hundreds of Marines come home from Lebanon in coffins, in a world that had watched 5 IRA prisoners starve themselves to death, among other dubious wonders. But it was true, all the same. He had killed the wife of the old gypsy with the rotting nose, and his sometime golf partner, good old tit-grabbing Judge Kerry Rossington, had let him off without even so much as a tap on the wrist. And so the old gypsy had decided to impose his own sort of justice on one fat Fairview lawyer whose wife had picked the wrong day to give him his first and only hand job in a moving car. The sort of justice a man like his sometime friend Ginelli might appreciate. Halleck turned off the bathroom light and went downstairs, thinking of death row convicts walking down the last mile. "No blindfold, fada, but who's got a cigarette?" He smiled wanly. Heidi was sitting at his desk, the bills on her left, the glowing screen in front of her, the Marine Midlands checkbook propped on the keyboard like sheet music. A common enough sight on at least one night during the first week of the new month. But she wasn't writing checks or running figures. She was only sitting there, a cigarette between her fingers, and when she turned to him, Billy saw such woe in her eyes that he was almost physically staggered. He thought of selective perception again, the funny way your mind had of not seeing what it didn't want to see, like the way you kept pulling your belt smaller and smaller to hold your oversized pants up around your shrinking waistline, or the brown circles under your wife's eyes, or the desperate question in those eyes. "Yeah, I'm still losing weight," he said. "Oh, Billy," she said, and exhaled in a long, trembling sigh. But she looked a little better, and Halleck supposed she was glad it was out in the open. She hadn't dared mention it, just as no one at the office had dared to say, "Your clothes are starting to look like they came from Omar the Tentmaker, Billy boy."
Say, you haven't got a growth or anything, do you? Somebody hit you with the old cancer stick, did they, Billy? You got yourself a great big old tumor inside you someplace, all black and juicy, sort of a rotted human toadstool down there in your gut sucking you dry? Oh, no. Nobody says that shit. They let you find it out for yourself. One day you're in court and you start to lose your pants when you stand up to say, "Your Honor, I object," in the best Perry Mason tradition, and nobody has to say a motherfucking word. "Yeah," he said, and then actually laughed a little, as if to cover same. "How much?" "The scale upstairs says I'm down to 188. "Oh, Christ." He nodded toward her cigarettes. "Can I have one of those?" "Yes, if you want one. Billy, you're not to say a word to Linda about this, not one." "Don't have to," he said, lighting up. The first drag made him feel dizzy. That was okay. The dizziness was kind of nice. It was better than the numb horror that accompanied the end of the selective perception. "She knows I'm still losing weight. I've seen it on her face. I just didn't know what I was seeing until tonight." "You've got to go back to see Houston," she said. She looked badly frightened, but that confused expression of doubt and sorrow was gone from her eyes now. "The metabolic series..." "Heidi, listen to me," he said, and then stopped. "What?" she asked. "What, Billy?" For a moment he almost told her everything. Something stopped him, and he was never sure later what it was, except that, for one moment, sitting there on the edge of his desk and facing her with their daughter watching TV in the other room and one of her cigarettes in his hand, he felt a sudden savage moment of hate for her. The memory of what had happened, what had been happening, in the minute or so before the old gypsy woman darted out into the traffic, returned to him in a flash of total recall. Heidi had scooted over next to him and put her left arm around his shoulders. And then, almost before he was aware it had happened, she had unzipped his fly. He felt her fingers, light and oh so educated, slip through the gap and then through the opening in his shorts. In his teens, Billy Halleck had occasionally perused, with sweaty hands and slightly bulging eyes, what were referred to by his peers as stroke books. And sometimes in these stroke books a hot bimbo would wrap her educated fingers around some fellow's stiffening member. All nothing but wet dreams set in type, of course. Except here was Heidi. Here was his wife gripping his own stiffening member. And by damn, she was beginning to jerk him off. He had glanced at her, astonished, and had seen the roguish smile on her lips. "Heidi, what are you..." "Shh! Don't say a word." What had possessed her? She had never done such a thing before, and Halleck would have sworn that such a thing had never crossed her mind. But she had done it, and the old gypsy woman had darted. "Oh, tell the truth. As long as the scales are dropping from your eyes, you might as well drop all of them, don't you think? You got no business lying to yourself. The hour's gotten too late for that. Just the facts, ma'am." "All right. The facts." The fact was that Heidi's unexpected move had excited him tremendously, probably because it had been unexpected. He had reached for her with his right hand, and she had pulled her skirt up, exposing a perfectly ordinary pair of yellow nylon panties. Those panties had never excited him before, but they did now. Or perhaps it was the way she had pulled up her skirt that had excited him. She had never done that before, either. The fact was that about 85% of his attention had been diverted from his driving, although in 9 out of 10 parallel worlds, things probably still would have turned out perfectly okay. During the business week, Fairview streets were not just quiet. They were downright somnolent. But never mind that. The fact was that he hadn't been in 9 out of 10 parallel worlds. He had been in this one. The fact was that the old gypsy woman hadn't darted out from between the Subaru and the Firebird with the racing stripes. The fact was that she simply walked from between the two cars,
holding a net bag full of purchases in one gnarled and liver-spotted hand, the sort of net bag English women often take with them when they go shopping along the village high street. There had been a box of Dove's laundry powder in the gypsy woman's net bag. Halleck remembered that. She had not looked. That was true enough. But the final fact was just that Halleck had been doing no more than 35 miles an hour, and he must have been almost 150 feet from the gypsy woman when she stepped out in front of his Olds. Plenty of time to stop, if he had been on top of the situation. But the fact was that he was on the verge of an explosive orgasm, all but the tiniest fraction of his consciousness fixed below his waist, as Heidi's hand squeezed and relaxed, slipped up and down with slow and delicious friction, paused, squeezed, and relaxed again. His reaction had been hopelessly slow, hopelessly too late, and Heidi's hand had clamped on him, stifling the orgasm that shock had brought on for one endless second of pain and a pleasure that was inevitable but still gruesome. Those were the facts. But hold it a second, folks. Hang on a bit, friends and neighbors. There were two more facts, weren't there? The first fact was that if Heidi hadn't picked that particular day to try out a little autoeroticism, Halleck would have been on top of his job, and his responsibility as the operator of a motor vehicle, and the Olds would have stopped at least 5 feet short of the old gypsy woman, stopped with a screech of brakes that would have caused the mothers wheeling their babies across the common to look up quickly. He might have shouted, "Why don't you look where you're going?" at the old woman, while she looked at him with a species of stupid fright and incomprehension. He and Heidi would have watched her scurry across the street, their hearts thudding too hard in their chests. Perhaps Heidi would have wept over the fallen grocery bags and the mess on the carpet in the back. But things would have been all right. There would have been no hearing, and no old, rotten-nosed gypsy waiting outside to caress Halleck's cheek and whisper his dreadful one-word curse. That was the first ancillary fact.